Welcome to the Design the Future podcast, where we talk with women leading the way towards a better built world. Design the Future is hosted by me, Lindsay Baker, with Kira Gould. Let's get started.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Design the Future podcast. It's good to be with you. This is Lindsay.
And this is Kira.
You're back. It's been a little bit of time, Kira, since I got to hang out with you. I hope you're doing okay.
I'm doing great. I've been on the road, but you've been on the road even more. So maybe you should tell us a little bit about where you've been, because you've been all over the place.
All over the place. I have to say, yeah. I mean, I also it's an especially good feeling that my whole team has been kind of all over the place. We've been doing all these exciting things. Just this past week was the Design for Freedom Summit. Mm-hmm. We were at the White House. We had this amazing meeting. With a new client, a very new, exciting client that's pursuing a living building. Let's see. There's all these other things going on this week. Oh, Mass Timber Conference. I mean, this will also, of course, publish when you all, it's too late to go to these events, but spring conferences, man, it turns out there's a whole bunch of them that are really worth going to. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you thought you only had conference travel in the fall, you were sorely mistaken. But I went to Paris for this event that the UN put on. The very first forum, I guess they called it, on climate and buildings, that was sort of a follow-on from COP, but specific to buildings, and was really just about 800 people, I think they said. So a lot of government folks, and then a lot of NGO folks from around the world. And it was a really cool moment to just have a lot of people in the same room. I mean, you know, my read on it is a couple of things. It's that UN and these sorts of big international NGO style collaborations or government style collaborations, like, they can be pretty dry and pretty sort of bureaucratic in their presentation of what's happening. So in case you're imagining a world in which, like, actual leaders sit around a nice big table and, like, really discuss the, you know, what are the real baselines that we should be using for embodied carbon numbers as a, you know, like, as a frame? Of course, that doesn't happen. That's not like, it's like, you know, like some minister shows up and says, I really care about this. Our country really cares about this. And we are updating our building codes. And then the next person comes up and says, I really care about this. And our country really cares about this. And we are also updating our building codes. You know, like, that's kind of a little how it sounds. And you're in the room. The more important thing is that there, you know, there's sort of these machinations in the side of these events that help to align our movement towards the most important things we need to be doing, specifically on climate, to change the industry, to transform the industry in line with the Paris Agreement. And one of the things that I want people to know about that you should look up is this Buildings Breakthrough Agenda, which has a specific set of very targeted actions that, you know, different folks around the world are taking on at a high level to unlock and help to accelerate the transition of the building industry. So it's a cool sort of one-stop shop of what do we need to do? And it's a bit high level, but there's still a lot of activity going on at that level. So if you ever wonder, at least for climate, like, what's the grand plan? That document's pretty close to a grand plan. So that's nice that we have that. But of course, you know, we all still know from our work and what we interview people about that, like, the work happens on the ground in communities and
that's right.
The subtle, you know, changes that we make to practice every day. So I wouldn't say that there's somehow like a puppet master.
Right.
It's just nice. Yeah. You know?
Yes, but it's still nice, I think, to be working towards shared guiding goals and principles and, you know, desired outcomes and things like that, because it really does help to coalesce things and stop working in, you know, 19 silos with 45 different standards and tools and all those things.
Yeah. And we did have some early conversations that were very promising, I think, around standards alignment, certifications alignment around the world.
Great.
And that was the first time that kind of thing had happened in my tenure ever, where you get a bunch of you know, a bunch of the usual suspects who are responsible for certifications all in the same room talking about what it would look like to align better. So yeah, that was all really, really worthwhile. And, you know, Paris, I ate a lot of pastries. I feel great about that.
Fantastic. I'm happy that you did that. And yeah, some good cheese too, I hope.
Totally good cheese. Yes, they really know how to make cheese over there. In case we all didn't know that. Yeah, brushed up a little bit of my French, ordered some cheese in French, felt proud of myself. It was great. Felt good to be there.
Excellent. Well, I'm happy you're back and it sounds productive and I'm glad about that too. So yeah, that's great. But I am excited. I'm super excited. And probably our guest today can share some insight on some of those general topics, you know, trying to bring cohesion around a broad number of people and parties trying to move towards common goals and things like that. We are super, super excited to have Janice Barnes with us today as our guest. Welcome, Janice.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me here. And thanks to the two of you and all the other women who have been part of this, because it's quite an inspirational group.
Oh, thank you so much. It's great to have you. I'm going to do an intro for anyone who is not familiar with Janice, and then we will jump right into questions. Dr. Janice Barnes is founder of Climate Adaptation Partners, which is a New York City-based partnership that focuses on planning, advocacy, and partnership building for climate adaptation. With technical training in architecture and organizational behavior, she helps clients understand their risks, evaluate their risk tolerances and possible adaptation pathways given current and expected exposures, and link these to appropriate design and financing or funding options. Working from the intersection of climate change, design, and public health, Janice links environmental, social, and economic indicators to advance resilience principles and connect knowledge across communities. Her work stands on three powerful words, and I love this. How might we? Janice, I'm so excited to have you explain how might we to us, but also we'd love for you to start by sharing a little bit about your path. Can you tell us about how and why you got involved in architecture and then climate adaptation work after that?
Sure, sure. And thanks for the invitation to even reflect on that history. It is a gift, I think, that you give to everyone whom you invite to this podcast, just to say, take a moment and look back and think about that question. When I did that, I thought about a gentleman in my youth who helped a young person in Appalachia, which is where I'm from, understand that architecture could be a career and helped me with the trajectory of getting to that place. I came from a small community in Appalachia where I was very fortunate to be surrounded by a very loving extended family and an incredibly helpful teacher, Donald Frazier. It was interesting to think about the options that you could have in a place where at that time there were no architects. So I always think back on the guidance that he provided and the support of my incredible family, who gives me opportunity and courage still every single day. I became an architect kind of from the side of how do you put a building together, and practiced as a traditional architect from the 1990s through about 2018. 2019 is when we started this company. But I spent the majority of my career at Perkins & Will. While I was there, a good chunk of that time, I led the consultancy practice where we focused on strategy. A lot of that was at a portfolio level. And with Perkins & Will, as many folks know, there's an incredible emphasis on sustainability from the get-go. And when we started paying even closer attention to the larger issues of adaptation and climate mitigation and adaptation came together, we established a resilience lab, which I co-directed with Doug Pierce from Minneapolis, Minnesota, for many years. We worked across the firm. At that point, there were about 24 offices across different countries. And what we were trying to do there was to build up capacity across the practice, recognizing projects like the one that Robin Gunther led for Spalding Rehab in Charlestown, Mass., but also projects like the Rockefeller 100 Resilient Cities Plans, and something we're really proud of, an effort that followed Hurricane Maria, where Janelle Diangle, who is now the managing director of the Boston office, and a handful of folks working post-Maria started something called Resiliency, Social, Economic, Environmental, Puerto Rico. And that integration has continued as an advocacy group, as an organization that brings together community-based planning, things like that. We also were able to integrate resilient thinking into the annual design reviews that Perkins & Will did. And I think that really goes to the incredible leadership of Phil Harrison at the head of the firm, who said, absolutely, this is what we need to be thinking about. So I was very fortunate to be in a practice with an incredible network across so many places where everyone was kind of pulling in the same direction and doing what I would consider to be groundbreaking work that still needs to be done, I think, in some places. But that groundbreaking work is the role I think that large firms need to play, because you have some additional capacity, and that material, whatever you make, needs to be shared very broadly. So that's how I got there. And I was just really fortunate to be in a place with a set of extraordinary colleagues who were able to help grow together.
That's fascinating. And yeah, I mean, even just to think about what it takes for a firm to make that transition to taking something seriously, it's really nice to just hear the points along that, Janice. Thank you. Okay, so a little bit more specifically about you, we want to know strengths and sort of what people might want to know around climate adaptation work. What should they be good at? What should they be interested in? It's sort of the question. Like, you know, you got where you were in probably a pretty unique way, but if you could help people navigate their way to a similar space with any tips you might have or cautions or encouragement.
Well, it's a growing industry, unfortunately. And fortunately, we have some tools we can use. One of the things that we did at Perkins & Will, and I think this is something that anybody could do in their practice, is to ask three basic questions of any project that you're touching at any point in your career. And those three questions are, what are the climate projections in the place where you're working? So you should know those. What do those projections mean in terms of the kinds of hazards, the kinds of risk, and the vulnerabilities associated with them? And given whatever your scope is within your design work, what can you do about that? And if you think about those three questions as a basic framework, that's what we did at Perkins & Will. We set up those three questions and we looked at every one of our projects with that lens to say, do we know the climate? Do we know what the implications are? And do we know what we can do about it? Right? So I would definitely say, recognize that you don't get to opt in to climate change. It's opting out if you're not dealing with it. Ask those three questions. And when you think about the fact that this work is so pervasive in the entire structure of what design is actually about, you have to ask yourself as well, what is your professional responsibility, your moral responsibility, your strategic responsibility to tackle this? Someone once asked me when I had a challenging situation that I was trying to deal with, how do you want to hold your time? And it was such a terrific question. That question was a moment, kind of like being invited to participate with you today, of reflection. And it's about how, as you look at your professional career, the way you want to live your life, your world with your family, however you choose to answer that question, how do you want that to actually be spent? And when you think about this grand challenge and the importance it has and the important role that the design practice can bring to collaborations about that, how do you want to hold your time? Are you asking those three questions of everything that you're touching? And are you opting in as you should, like being really purposeful about that? That's what I mean. Climate change is going to happen. It's happening. Are you opting in to make sure that your practice aligns with those things in all the places that you're working? We pulled together a hashtag, we can't unknow this, as a key message. There's a woman in the field who said something similar to me years ago as part of convening where she was saying that folks would come and ask her questions and about climate and how they need to be thinking about it. And she said, I'm going to tell you, but then you can't unknow this after I tell you. So we really heard her when she said that, and we're trying to continue to emphasize this is such a well-known concern. It is a growing concern. We can't unknow this, and we have a professional responsibility at a minimum to get involved in it. And I just want to, I mean, that sounds a little bit judgmental. I don't mean it to be, because I do think this is extraordinary work. It is extraordinary work to be fortunate to be a part of. It's the kind of rejuvenating work where we can truly make a difference in the way that we contribute our small part into this much larger challenge. And I would just encourage people to take this on. And one thing I would say is that history hasn't always been kind to design industry who, when we've chosen to ignore key parts of the relationships within our practice. So we have entire industries that have kind of spawned for things that we didn't want to deal with. And we don't want climate adaptation industry to spawn out of design, but to be part of design as well. So we would say, always be curious, a little Ted Lasso there, but it is an important message. The other thing that's really important is that this work is hard work. The issues are daunting, and collaboration is key. David Wagner, a colleague of mine from New Orleans, said it best when he said, you need a lot of friends to do this work. And then Jean Baker Miller, the way that she described the work of relational practice, and she was just an extraordinary scholar in the relational practice founding. She said, you need zest. And zest is that kind of interpersonal reward that comes when you're working with people where you're energized by your collaboration together. And I think that this challenge that we have introduces the opportunity for those kinds of zesty relationships with colleagues who become friends as you tackle these hard problems that are not only your professional responsibility, but moral responsibility. And given the growth in the industry, you could even argue a strategic responsibility.
That's so rich. There's so many things there, Janice, that I love so much. And in particular, I guess what strikes me is how convinced I am that this work is particularly valuable and exciting, because it is that hard stuff that we don't always pay attention to in design. Like, I love this point that sometimes when designers haven't been willing to take something on, a little industry builds up to take it on for them. And yeah, we have that potential with adaptation, climate adaptation work to not bifurcate right now. So it's just really, that's a really inspiring point. And I'm excited for people to take up that challenge. So yeah, that's so much more we could talk about there, but I suspect we will continue to touch on it as we go through maybe more of the nitty gritty. So tell us a little bit about what you are most proud of accomplishing in your work life so far. I mean, gosh, honestly, even just holding that point about how we need to integrate this into design feels like a big one. But what for you have been some of your highlights?
That's such a great question. Being prideful is not something that is part of my culture. So it was hard to think about this a bit. But then I thought, where are the inspirations in this work? So one of the things that you could say proud, but it's more about inspired by, when you see a company like Perkins & Will transform, where the seeing differently, thinking about resilience more holistically became part and parcel of the way the firm was doing the work. And because of the responsibility that that firm takes on in its leadership role as part of the larger design practices nationally and internationally, they take the responsibility to pass that on. So seeing other firms transition because of what's been put out in the marketplace, that's really inspiring. It makes you see where change can come from. And I think the other thing that's really inspiring is when I see folks like Megan Ricker's firm, Place Collaborative, it's a Utah-based practice, taking the knowledge, deep sustainability knowledge, deep climate adaptation knowledge, and helping other firms move along in that pathway in such an open way, as opposed to kind of treating it like a trade secret. Megan's voice is just so powerful. Hopefully she'll be a voice on this podcast at some point, but that kind of thinking, that hashtag sharing is caring, so to speak, is really something to be inspired by. I think another thing that's quite fulfilling is the greater work that I've been able to take on with public health practitioners. Obviously, we all know health, safety, welfare. How do we get those credits? We've got to keep our license fresh, that sort of thing. But when I look back at your podcast, I see that that's a common theme across many of your guests, which is really interesting to see. And then thinking about that, well, who are their friends? Who are the public health professionals? Like, name your favorite epidemiologist. Those are places I think that we can see inspiration when we sit down as designers with folks who have that kind of deep experience, and we really think about how the environment, climate change issues in the environment impact public health, and then have a real conversation with the person who's tracking that to be able to say, well, what can we do? What's really applicable as opposed to what we'd like to do? I'd say the same thing about becoming quite familiar with climate scientists, like name your favorite climate scientist. And these things aren't typically part of at least my design education. It required me to take on an atypical role as an architect. And one of the examples that I give in this, when we go to design school, we're taught to stand up and defend our ideas, to negotiate, to present. And that's what you might consider a lead guitar, right? You're out in front of the band. And one of the things that's so interesting in this work, so inspiring, is when you realize that there is a role to play. To play rhythm guitar. You don't always have to be in the front of the room. Sometimes you can step back, you can play that rhythm guitar, and what you actually can contribute is the design thinking that you're so familiar with, but you've brought different kinds of bandmates to the table. You brought that climate science expert, you brought that epidemiologist to the table, and what you actually come up with is so much better than the kind of single discipline or the typical collected disciplinary work that we're more familiar with. So I would say the inspirations that I'm proud to be involved with are things like that.
Janice, I just love that example. I think that's so terrific. And my mind was just spinning while you were talking about so many of the things and how we, you know, things that aren't taught in the schools, and then also sort of patterns of working that aren't really taught in the schools right now, or not as much. I mean, maybe that's being begun to be taught now. I don't know. But I love this example. And I do feel that some young practitioners, you mentioned Megan's work, and, you know, are more comfortable with fluid roles and those kinds of things. So maybe there is, you know, a real shift happening in the practice that we can celebrate the rhythm guitar role more. I don't know. I'm hoping. I think it's a fantastic example and way to think about that. And I love that idea that you're bringing design thinking, but different, but also these other people to the table. It's wonderful. I'm wondering if there's a project that you're working on right now that you would like listeners to know about.
That is such a kind question. Thank you for asking it. Over the last several years, I've been working more and more on the intersection of public health, climate adaptation, and design. And it's just been a rich, rich place to learn. The American Medical Association a couple of years back declared climate change a health emergency. So being able to think about, well, what role does design play in health? And we certainly have plenty of healthcare designers within the industry. But when we start talking about public health and having a public health practitioner at the table with designer, when you're thinking about some change in a public realm or in a building or whatever it might be, that's different. And I think that's something I'd like to talk about. There are some new resources that we've been able to be a part of. The New York State Climate Impact Assessment was just released. I had the good fortune of working with Perry Sheffield, who's a pediatrician at Mount Sinai, as well as other medical professionals. And it was just a fascinating group to be a part of. The New York State Climate Impacts Assessment is online at the NYSERDA site. There are chapters there on buildings, on energy, transportation, water, economy, and society. There are many architects involved, some of whom you probably know. The New York State AIA is going to do a review of that project on May the 1st, if anybody's interested in tuning in on that. So it's, to me, it's always compelling to think about the climate materials that are available to us, from the IPCC to the National Climate Assessment, to a state assessment, to a local assessment. This nested scales approach is quite pertinent to talk about. And to that end, New York City is releasing what's called the New York City Panel on Climate Change Fourth Iteration Assessment next month. And we've been really fortunate to be a part of that as the firm. But prior to taking on work with MPCC directly, I was a co-chair with Tom Matei, who's an epidemiologist, and we were co-chairing the health working group with folks like Kim Knowlton, who teaches at Mailman, as well as was recently for many years with the Natural Resources Defense Council, or folks like Katie Lane, who is also an epidemiologist at the New York City Department of Health and Mental Health. So being able to work with experts like that, or Deborah Balk, who's an expert in population demography, we have this incredible assessment to say, across the five boroughs, how will climate impact, how is the climate changing? There's a climate science group. How is equity centered in that? It's a central, that was a key part of the previous iteration of the MPCC, and now it is present as a central focus in every work group for the forthcoming MPCC. How do you think about futuring and scenario-based planning? How do you think about flooding specifically? How do you begin to think about the issues of health more directly, to the example I was sharing? So I'm really proud of those projects and seeing how they begin to nest as the IPCC, the NCA, the New York State, and now the city begin to release. And then what do you do with that? We also just had good fortune. I had the good fortune of working with Tracy Simpier as a co-chair for a National Academies consensus study. This was the community-driven relocation consensus study. So we're looking at the five states facing the Gulf Coast and thinking about how the term managed retreat is being considered, to what extent the consensus study was looking at the extent to which it was already occurring, what lessons might we learn, those sorts of things. That was just released a couple of months ago, and the public release event is next month in New Orleans. It was such an interesting study to realize that well-being is kind of a keystone missing element in a lot of these conversations, where buyouts or more traditional, how do we deal with this flooded property exercise, the kind of capital side of it was really the most pertinent thing that had traditionally been focused on. So working with folks in public health who were able to raise up the way we think about well-being as central to these issues, and community-driven decision-making as central to well-being. It's such a wonderful, wonderful outcome. Just encouraging anyone who's interested to look at the National Academy site on that. And then maybe just a couple other things. A few years ago, I was able to work with Hillary Nelson and Matthias Bau to co-create a new course at Penn, where we took Perelman School of Medicine public health students and Weitzman School of Design architecture, landscape, city planning students, and put them together for the first time ever in a course to think about climate, public health, and city design. So that's really a multidisciplinary course that's transforming some conversations. We recently presented that at the Global Consortium on Climate and Health Education that Columbia hosts, and there's a recording of that if anyone's interested in looking. What is that all to say? It's all to say this health safety welfare credit system that we have within our industry, it is necessary, but it's not sufficient. So I think the opportunity that we have and what we've been able to do, what I've been able to do in my practice, is focus in these places where substantive change is really necessary. And back to that point on how do you want to hold your time, where I feel like my contribution can make the biggest positive impact. So it's energizing. I hope that comes across.
In every way, Janice. If that is an amazing array of things, and we will do our best to provide all the relevant links and tags so that people can find all those interesting resources. What a collection. And I'm just so fascinated by so many of those elements. So thank you for all of that. And for the, you know, I love that notion that health, safety, and welfare, that it's just, you know, too narrowly focused, really. That's very interesting. I want to zoom out just a little bit for the next phase of this conversation, though, because we like to talk a little bit about sort of how practice fits into the kind of into the broader movement, which is sometimes what we call this. So green building and resilience work and all those activities are often thought of as part of a movement, as well as just part of a certain industry or sector. And I'm just wondering, how do you think about those things? Do you feel like you're part of a movement or an industry, or how do you think about those things for yourself?
Well, I think that green building is a little delimiting in terms of our role. When we think of design, I think of it much broader than the building per se. While it brings and historically brought an important focus on mitigation and GHG reduction, necessary but not sufficient. We know that we have enough carbon in the atmosphere now to have a level of lock-in through our mid, if not end of century. When we think about tracking emissions, there was a PNAS paper maybe 3 years ago that tracked historical projections compared to actual, and there was an alignment on the higher emissions future. So if we're kind of heading up the hockey stick without a paddle, so to speak, we really need to be looking beyond the kind of 2100 conversation. We need to be looking beyond just mitigation. It has to be and, my favorite conjunction, if you remember that, to really understand kind of the 2300 IPCC curves and what that actually means, and the move up beyond the end of the century, and really a change to from thinking about a green building and the importance of that to systems of multi-generational thinking, where lifespans of assets, the service life, the risk tolerances, buying down risk for the next generation become a key part of the conversation. So it changes the nature of the trajectory that we're on. For example, I live in a building that is almost 100 years old. And when we think about those things, we have to think about, well, how in New York, we have a lot of very old buildings here. And we have to think about readiness of not only the building, but also the neighborhood and the systems that serve the neighborhood to meet that kind of change across that much longer trajectory. So the Climate Resilience Design Guidelines, New York City has, for example, uses service life categorizations, if anybody wants to look those up. Spalding, that I mentioned before, it's a fantastic project, a fantastic piece of architecture and site that's kind of fitting into the neighborhood in such a unique way. But when you look at the character of the housing surrounding the area, you have a majority of circa early 1900s to maybe 1930s, 1940s housing, that's not ready for the kind of retrofits that are necessary, much less the systems that are necessary to change. So systemically, for Spalding to be successful long-term, then the neighborhood, the perimeter protection, the entire system has to be improved. So it's not a knock on green building. It's just to say, you got to have more friends.
I love that point that you have to have more friends, but also just, yeah, the way that that context can work. Well, okay. So then I have to say, I love the fact that you're asking us to think more about like 2300 and the and that long-term future. So it's probably a weird thing to ask about 2020, the year 2020, that, or sort of the 2020s and where we are. I guess I'm curious to see or hear if you feel like we are where we should be as a community on some of these things, or kind of how your trajectory of getting interested in adaptation in particular has made you feel. I guess, are we behind, or are we like, would you like to have seen more progress by now? Like all of those kinds of questions about where we sit today compared to where we could be sitting today.
Well, that's a question of luxury, isn't it? Just to be able to say, well, woulda, shoulda, coulda. Mm. I think optimistically, I hoped, when I kind of look back at that self, I hope that everyone in design would see climate as part of their responsibility. Right? It's a collective. So we're not there yet. And I'm not sure that we're making those design decisions that say, do you know what the climate projections are? Do you understand the hazards, the risk and the vulnerabilities associated? And are you doing something about it? So I don't think we're there yet. I think we have some challenges that come from issues around ownership. I mean, even the question around mitigation, sometimes the folks who are prioritizing mitigation, because that's what they do, have a bit of an ownership, like GHG mitigation versus, say, hazard mitigation. There have been arguments that I've been in where I've been asked to not use the word mitigation because it, quote, belongs to GHG. And my reaction was, well, you should tell FEMA because they run this hazard mitigation program and it's pretty popular. But when we think about the domain ownership, that I think that's where we get into one of the challenges about design adoption. So Kirsten Dow, Kirsten is an extraordinary scientist. She's working at University of South Carolina. She and I wrote a paper called Water and Heat, Intervening in Hazard Bias. Yeah, hazard bias is a term that our firm uses to reflect on the fact that we've kind of set down these domain parameters that we're unwilling to kind of shake free of. And when we think about that, these kind of edges that are either our edges within the industry or what we're seeing in the way that disaster declarations are run, focusing on, for example, capital assets, but not really focused on human assets. For example, there have been no, I think this is still true, as of 2024, still no federally declared heat disasters. So when we think about these things and we think about the challenges that we have in the industry, we're going to have to ask about those three words that you opened with a little bit more frequently and a little bit differently. We're going to have to recognize that climate doesn't stay inside the meets and bounds of our site boundaries, that the systems views that I was mentioning before are quite critical. And this is a theme from others in your podcast, so I know I'm not the only one saying this. We also have to think about the fact that these issues have to be sustained. The multi-generational issue is really quite pertinent, but even sustained within the course of a year-over-year basis, Richard Moss, also an extraordinary climate scientist, has written extensively about the issue of sustained assessment and what that actually means for the kind of work that needs to be done. But we tend to, in our industry, we tend to say, well, my project started, my project stopped, maybe I'll check back in later and see how it's going. But am I really thinking about the design in a way that says, I understand how I need to design for now, and I also need to understand, given those climate projections, given those service lives, what it actually means to design in adaptive capacity? What is ready for now? And what is the adaptive capacity and what is that transition plan? That's a different way of thinking than what we've traditionally done. So the resolution of this takes a much longer view. And it also means that we have to acknowledge when there are limits to adaptation. Kirsten and others have written about this within the framework of national climate assessments and otherwise. So you think about, well, how much can you do? And then when is there a transformationally different solution that needs to be proposed? So that gives you the optionality to plan a service life that is reasonable given what we know right now, but also to prepare for when significant transformation needs to occur and kind of give the runway for how to get there. So we go back to those three questions And then we think about those first three words that you raised, how might we, for our firm, it's how is process, so what is the process that we need to set up to make that happen? Might is possibility, how do we build in our optionality and how do we have those conversations with colleagues and clients? And we is really understanding the collective intent and what the network around those solution-making processes needs to be in order to actually put something substantive in place. So while we have global advocates around these issues, we don't quite yet have full adoption. So you'll be able to highlight and say, but look, this has been done. That's fantastic that we're seeing exemplary projects, but we're not seeing pervasive integration. So I think it's an evolving process and we have to celebrate the small wins, but we have to keep the horizon on in our sights so that we are making progress toward that much larger curve that's beyond that 2100 cutoff for most projects.
Yeah, it's just such deep work that you're talking about. It, I mean, I love this way of thinking about how might we, as a set of powerful words, and also just the emphasis that that places on changing our process, changing our frame, changing how we even, you know, like even what you were saying about, you know, architects not being sort of thinking about themselves as presenting at the front of the room. That all just feels like these sort of very structural shifts that I really feel really important. I'm really great to hear you talk through how that can happen. So thank you. So, I mean, this maybe draws us still into these questions of structures, but I want to know where you feel like we have done well in the world of sustainability in buildings and where you think we haven't made as much progress. And it could either be at these maybe more cultural and structural levels or you know, topic-wise or however you think about it.
It's a great question. I do believe in the small wins are a big deal. I'm going to put that on a t-shirt someday, hashtag small wins are a big deal, because we have to celebrate the milestones. And I think that having guidance, so from the time I became an architect to now, we have guidance. We have structures that help us understand what the highest performance target is, what's reasonable to achieve, what's possible to achieve. We have tools and organizations to help us get there. We have peer-to-peer learning. We can get our annual credits in ways that are actually pertinent to this. And it wasn't like that when I started. So it's really important to understand that we are at this moment that is part of this lengthy trajectory of this industry. And there have been some extraordinary changes that have happened in a very short amount of time within the length of the industry's trajectory. So I think those are the things to celebrate, but there are also things to be precautionary about. And by precautionary, I'm suggesting that sometimes I think any architect who might be listening to this is probably saying, I'm too busy to deal with all the things that she just said. So that's a problem, because sometimes you get so comfortable with the tools that you've got a hammer and everything looks like a nail. And that's when we get into trouble, because the climate isn't static. What we're seeing is a foundational change in the very way of living on this earth. So we have to ask ourselves, do the tools create a level of support that keeps us from thinking more critically about what needs to evolve and at what pace? I also think that we still have far, far too many accolades, banners, fellowships, scholarships, etc., that promote work that is not climate inclusive. So my personal bias, speaking of hazard bias, my personal bias is that you should not receive any design award for any project or any recognition, any publication for any project, if that project has not considered climate change as a key criterion within the design brief.
Hear, hear.
Yay.
Sorry, couldn't resist. Completely agree. It's so frustrating. Okay.
Totally. Oh, I love that. Well, speaking of accolades, we have one last question for you, Janice. So I'm excited to let you give some people their flowers that are doing this kind of work. But can you share with us who you're most inspired by these days in terms of leaders of any kind? Who would you like for us to be looking to and knowing about?
There are many, and that's such a hard question because I don't know, you need kind of a mirror board to keep pinning things to. I thought about this in terms of scales. So globally, the folks who are looking at the One Health movement, the WHO and UN have been talking about this a long time. You might have talked about it when you were in Paris. But those collaborators who are looking at systemic integration, and it's just phenomenal to read about the work in One Health, to think about the implications as we look back at the impact of COVID, for example. So if we're not considering One Health, we're missing a keystone conversation. So I would look for not a person there, but look at the material from the WHO and the UN on One Health. Nationally, I would say let's recognize the federal partners who are modeling a fuller collaboration across agencies to bring climate resources freely available to bear in decision making, like John Balbus at HHS, David Harrington, Ned Garner at NOAA, Lori Showman, who's now at CEQ. These folks are out there and they are getting resources in hands that don't sit behind a paywall. That is powerful. The regional planning groups like Regional Plan Association in the Northeast or Rebuild by Design that are tackling hard questions like how does retreat work in this area, or how might we find water to serve a growing population? So the folks who are creating those convenings and opening them up across and beyond technical groups, local groups like community health ambassadors who are linking the COVID issues and climate change and really working on building out trusted and sustained networks in their communities while helping the community members better understand their risk and their options. An example is an organization like the Greater New Orleans Foundation, their Community Lighthouse program that's kind of resilience hubs before resilience hubs were cool, or their Next 100 Years program that's really trying to bring these resources to bear and help communities across the parish to get work done. And then topically, there are leaders like the NEP team in the UK who are leading on the rewilding effort by modeling it on their own property and showing how those transformations can occur, or finance leaders like Quantified Ventures who keep finding really creative ways to leverage private capital to make a difference for the greater good. And then generationally, this is the hope springs, right? The young people who recognize that this is their world and it will be a very different world, and who are engaged now in high school or even younger, and who will be there to drive the change that we need to see. So there are so many inspirations out there, and maybe that's one more thing to celebrate.
That is a great thing to celebrate. Thank you for that, Janice. And thank you so much for being on the podcast. It's been truly illuminating, but also just really lovely to hear about how you think about these things. So I hope it's inspired our listeners as much as it's inspired me.
Thank you for having me. And thanks to the two of you for the work that you're doing. It's a gift for anyone who has a chance to listen to your podcast, but also special for those of us who have a chance to talk with you directly.
Oh, of course. Of course. It's always our pleasure. And, you know, lovely to be back with you, Kira. And excited to keep all these conversations going.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a really good one. This was so interesting. I do think this might be the most things I will have to tag in any podcast so far.
I love that.
Which
I
is awesome.
That speaks very well of the interview. Thank you, Janice. And thanks, everybody. That is it for us this week on the Design the Future podcast. Please leave us a review on Apple. Keep them coming. It really matters. It helps people find us. Stay safe, and we'll see you next time.